I've read this quote every time, so this is why we can take one theme and trace it from the beginning. It's because we believe the Bible is a theologically unified, historically rooted, progressively unfolding, and ultimately Christ-centered narrative of God's covenant, that's what Greg will look at next time, work in our world to redeem sinful humanity and his creation. So amidst all the human authors and all the centuries, thousands of years of writing, there is one supreme author, God, who is carrying along his people by the Spirit. So that's telling one story. And therefore, there are themes that you can trace from the beginning to the end. And what we're going to look at today, and we're going to try to have a discussion, is this theme of the serpent, or we'll later have a description, the Satan, actually. But here you go. When you get to the Gospels, you'll notice this. This is from the Bible Project. A lot of this is from the Bible Project. One of the most striking things about Jesus in the New Testament is his awareness of an ultimate enemy, and it was not human. That the thing that Jesus, yes, of course, he cares about humanity. Of course, he's interacting with that. But his arch enemy, the one that he really came to destroy, was not human. It is, we're going to see who it is, okay? So, we're going to start where we always start in Genesis. This is a little bit debated, okay? But I think Bible Project has convinced me that once you see the theme in Scripture, you go back and see in Genesis 1 how the foundation is being set. All right, so when you're told right here, right, this is God creating the world, and in verse 21 it says, God created the great sea creatures and every living creature that moves with which the waters swarm. If you were in our, I think it was our first theme we did, the theme of water, how it becomes a symbol of chaos and a symbol of kind of decreation, because it was this unknown, it was this darkness. And what you see, if you really take that lens, you can go back. That word sea creatures, okay, is actually the Hebrew word tanin, which actually means dragon or serpent. And so, look, everything that God makes is good. But what you see is this picture of this creature that he made that is living out in the waters that later will be identified as chaos, later will be identified as kind of darkness. And so in this sense, you see that, look, we're going to talk about how these spiritual beings become evil and fall, but God does not create them that way. Everything that God makes is good. But there are these beings that are out in these waters that become a symbol of chaos. And as you follow that theme, you're going to realize that these beings, these dragons, this serpent, its goal is to bring God's creation back into chaos. So even here, if this really is pointing to what's going to be the serpent and other things, what is clearly stated from the beginning is Satan is not God's rival. He's not his opposite. There is no opposite of God. He is the only God. He holds all power. Actually, Satan and these spiritual forces of darkness, they're kind of the opposite. They're creatures, but after their fall, they're kind of the opposite of creation, of good creation. They want to destroy and divide and decay. That's more what their opposite is, okay? So I would suggest you get hints of it here, all right? You're free to disagree. But then when Genesis 3, it gets very explicit, okay? There's a serpent that's the Garden of Eden that was more crafty than any other beast, okay? Crafty, that's not always bad, but it can have the connotations of being something being cunning and deceptive, which I think is foreshadowing something about this serpent. And if you remember, we said this a lot, but Greg, week two or three, when he talked about temple, really pointed this out, that the Garden of Eden, right, before sin enters the world, it's where heaven and earth intersect. It is a temple. It's the way things are supposed to be. And therefore, you have God's space intersecting perfectly with our space, and so you have God dwelling there. You have angelic beings dwelling there, right? It talks about cherubim are going to be guarding the entrance of the Garden of Eden. All that to say, sin, right, means that we become blind to some things that are real and intangible. But in the garden, you could see. So, like, presumably in the garden, there were angelic beings around, okay? Because heaven and earth are together. So that is why I don't, this encounter with the serpent is not as odd as you would think if heaven and earth are together, okay? So there are debates. Is this an angelic being taking on a serpent form? Isn't an angelic being taking control of a serpent? I don't know, but this being is called a serpent, and it's more focused on what this being does. He tempts Eve. We know that God created all creatures. Everything that God created is good, but now this creature is against God, is distrusting God, and is trying to get Eve to join this. And so here's what you start seeing, the marks of whoever this being is, right? Eve says this. Eve says, the serpent deceived me. So one thing that this being does is he deceives. He manipulates truth. He distorts it. He convinces Eve what he had already convinced himself of, that God cannot be trusted, that God is not good, that if I'm really going to live, then I'm going to decide what is right and wrong. And he convinces Eve of that. And so you see that this being is deceptive, is against God. We've already been told that Adam and Eve are made in God's image. You realize he hates God's image. And then here's what's promised. Right, look at verse 14. So after the fall, after sin ruins everything, the Lord God said to the serpent, because you have done this, cursed are you above all livestock and above all the beasts of the field. On your belly you shall go, and dust you shall eat all the days of your life. I'll put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and her offspring. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel. So, right, we're saying that as you follow a theme throughout the Bible, it gets developed more and more. The lights come on more and more, so you understand more and more who this, what this theme is. And what you see is that there's a promise. Two things, that on your belly you shall go. This being is cursed. I'm going to come back to what in the world does it mean? Does that mean it was a walking snake? Does that mean it was a flying snake? And now it doesn't have legs? We're going to come back to that. But it does at least symbolically seem to promise that this thing is going to be defeated. And then explicitly he says there's going to be enmity. There's going to be hostility between this being and humanity, specifically God's people. That they will fight each other, but it's going to end by the serpent's head being crushed while it'll bruise the seed of the woman. And so a lot of people point to Genesis 3:15, say this is the first promise of the gospel, but this is what God says is going to happen, that this Satan, this serpent is going to keep fighting, and there will never be peace between God and God's people and this serpent. But eventually his head is going to be crushed, all right? So then you carry on. Again, we're going to move fast. Genesis 4, you have the story of Cain and Abel, right? Abel's offerings are accepted, Cain's are not. He gets angry. And listen to the language when God comes and warns Cain. He says, sin is crouching at the door, and its desire is contrary to you, but you must rule over it. Okay, what I would suggest is that as Cain is being tempted to commit the sin of murder, yes, there's sin in his heart, but you're now presented that also there's something outside of him that's tempting that which is in him. And I think you start getting a picture after Genesis 3 of how this serpent works now that he's been banished from the garden. He works by temptation, by kind of moving into the background. But he's still crouching. He's still he's playing this animal-like role, like the snake. And he tells half-truths. He deceives. He wants you to justify inappropriate behavior because he wants decreation. He wants you to be destroyed. And he still does that. I mean, think about how many half-truths we hold on to justify things that we do, right? I mean, if somebody lies to me, right, the half-truth is, okay, that person is now a liar. That's who they are. That's how I define them. If I can define you as a liar, then I can dismiss you. I can probably be mean to you. But that's a half-truth. That's not fully who that person is. That person's made in the image of God. That person is so... But But if I can reduce them down to just a half truth, then I can justify all kinds of behavior, right? That's the temptation. There are all kinds of half-truths coming at us. So Genesis 3 and 4, I'd say, set the template for how the spiritual evil is going to work. It entered through the serpent, through Adam and Eve. Now there's sin in us, but you realize there's still temptation going on around us. But here's what you see, and this is really important. Evil was not created by God. And it never comes from him. This is... I'm sure this is from Ricky. Well, I can't remember who I quoted from Ricky, but this is why I think it's so important to have, to understand the Bible's description of evil and the serpent. Because if you don't, I think what we end up doing is blaming God for things. And I think that's kind of what our culture still, for the most part, kind of believes in God in a lot of ways. Belief of Satan, I think, has kind of been cast to the side. But there is no darkness in God. There is nothing evil that comes from him. There's nothing nefarious that comes from him. There is another one who is the producer of evil, who distorts what is good. And it is just like we've got to remember that, or I think we can start twisting who God is, okay? So so then you have Genesis 4. So then here you go. You get to Exodus 1. And God's people have grown through Abraham. They're now becoming this huge population, and they're in Egypt. And the language of Pharaoh, right, as he watches God's people multiply, remember, God has promised there's going to be enmity. There's going to be hostility between the serpent and between the seed of the woman. And you start seeing this hostility in kind of unnerving ways. He says, let us deal shrewdly with them. And then he sets taskmaster over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. And he oppresses them. He ends up, if you remember, having children thrown into the Nile. Evil stuff, violence. It is a picture of evil, and it's a picture of this serpent and what he wants, decreation, destruction, destroying God's people, is now being manifest not just in the temptations of an individual, but now it's being manifested in the temptations and powers of rulers and even cultures like Egypt. And if you don't believe me, like Isaiah later on makes this very clear. Look what he says as Isaiah thinks about Egypt. Here's what he says. He's talking about God. He's talking about delivering them, but he makes reference back to Egypt. And he says this, "Was it not you who cut Rahab in pieces, who pierced the dragon?" Right, serpent, dragon. "Was it not you who dried up the sea, the waters of the great deep, who made the depths of the sea a way for the redeemed to pass over?" When Isaiah looks back at Pharaoh, he calls him the dragon. He calls him the serpent. He says what God was doing there was defeating this one who was trying to destroy his seed. So Isaiah identifies him as this kind of this serpent figure that is now influencing Pharaoh. All right, and so you're getting a kind of more developed picture of the serpent, that actually he's at work in kind of these empires and nations, inciting violence and oppression, all right? And then you get to David and Goliath. If you read through Judges, there's all these hints of these snaky ways that they're acting. But when you get to King David, right, Israel's best king, in many ways, what people start thinking, this is the champion, this is the promised seed, that's finally going to deliver us, going to destroy all evil. And you have this Philistine named Goliath. I say Philistine because that's how they say it in Hoosiers, if you've ever watched it, and Hoosiers is the greatest movie ever made. And in 1 Samuel, when it starts talking about Goliath, this representative of the Philistines, the description, if you look in the Hebrew, okay, the description of his armor and his head is all serpent language. Les actually talked about this a while ago, but he has a nakashet helmet. That is the root word for serpent. And so he is described as having scaly armor and a scaly helmet. Like the Hebrew writers knew what they were doing. They were saying, this is the serpent. This is the serpent at work. This nation that is trying to destroy Israel, this is under the influence of the serpent. And what does David do when he kills Goliath? He chops off his head, right? Oh, this is it. Maybe he's been defeated. No, but you're starting to see this picture of, okay, this serpent is kind of overtakes nations and there's violence, there's oppression, they're going after Israel. But a king from the line of Judah, from David's line, is somehow going to defeat this serpent, maybe cut off his head, right? And so again, picture's getting bigger and bigger. We're doing a very fast thing. Okay, here we go. Isaiah 6. I told you we'd talk about this on the belly. I'm like moving out onto some very iffy waters, okay? That's okay. I'm still thinking through this. This is what Bible Project pointed out. I think I'm almost convinced of this. So in Isaiah 6, when Isaiah sees into the temple, right? So the heaven and the earth again combined. And what he sees flying around the throne are seraphim, okay? You can see it right here. Seraphim is the Hebrew word for serpent. The only place in the Hebrew Bible where it is not translated serpent is right here. I don't know why. The other places, it's translated as serpent or snake. What that means is probably what Isaiah sees are some, they're heavenly beings, but they are dragon-like. And thus, I think what Isaiah is telling you is when God said, on your belly you will go, yes, he's promising his defeat, but he's also telling you that this was an angelic, this was a spiritual being who has been cast down. He was a former seraphim, okay, that has rebelled. Again, y'all are looking at me like this is crazy. I know this is out there, but I keep following the theme. I think it actually is there. So, now you're realizing, okay, this serpent was actually a heavenly being that has rebelled. And then when you get to Job, you start getting a very clear description. Again, if he's an angelic being and he can be in the heavenly courts, you see this figure, Satan. We say Satan. Actually, the Hebrew has an article in front of it. It's the. He's called the Satan, which is much more, I think, terrifying, the Satan. Because it's not his name, it's a description. The Satan means the adversary or the accuser. And you see that's what he's doing. He says he's roaming the earth, right, in language of he's down here, and he finds this person, Job, and he starts accusing Job. He starts saying, Job isn't righteous. The only reason that Job does anything for you is because you've made his life great. He doesn't love you, God. He just loves the stuff that you give him. He starts accusing him. That's what the serpent figure does. And so God allows, here we go, the Satan to bring all kinds of suffering and oppression. He does, onto Job, okay? And then when you get to Isaiah, you get this, you get the promise. As he's talking about how Israel's gonna be redeemed, look how he puts it. In that day, the Lord with his hard and great and strong sword will punish Leviathan, the fleeing serpent. Leviathan, the twisting serpent, he'll slay the dragon that is in the sea. So you get this promise, right? That I'm telling you, I'm going to take care of this thing. And then when you get to Ezekiel, I forgot to put Ezekiel. Here you go. Ezekiel 28 talks about the king of Tyre, okay? And then he starts using serpent language. So this prince of Tyre who's doing evil things, he looks at him and says, you were in the Garden of Eden. You deceived. And again, he's identifying that one who is in the Garden of Eden is influencing the prince of Tyre. Okay? So think about everything that you've gotten. This evil character that's being fleshed out, he is a seemingly former seraphim that has rebelled against God, hates God, is a creature, but is powerful. He tries to intimidate and oppress God's people. He's an accuser. He manipulates and twists the truth. And then you see that in Zechariah 3, where the Satan shows up again, and you have Joshua standing before an angel clothed in filthy garments. And the sign is saying, basically, he can't be here. Look how filthy he is, right? He's accusing. He can't be in the presence of God. And yet what God says is, remove the filthy garments from him. I've taken away your iniquity. I'll clothe you with pure vestments. Let them put a clean turban on his head. Now you're starting to get this picture that somehow the way that God is going to deal with this accuser is he is going to remove our filth. He's going to remove the thing that Satan accuses. And so the Old Testament, in a real sense, ends with that developed picture. This serpent is a powerful being who influences for violence and oppression and distorts truth and accuses, but God has promised to crush him through a royal seed of David, and somehow the crushing is going to remove the thing that Satan can accuse. All right? So we're going to, here's the last thing. You hear the word devil a lot, right? That's from the Greek word diabolos, which is a Greek from the accuser, okay? But Jesus sums up the devil with this. He's talking actually to religious leaders. He says, you are the father of the devil. Your will is to do your father's desires. He was a murderer from the beginning. So he's violent. He's a murderer. Does not stand in the truth because there is no truth in him. When he lies, he speaks out of his own character. There's Jesus' summation. Diabolos, which also means, again, accuser or adversary, stands against. He's a murderer. He's a liar. There is no truth in him. Okay, we're going to watch this Bible Project video really quick. There's going to be some stuff that seemed out there, but let's watch it, and then we're going to have a quick discussion. All right, wild stuff, right? So that basically ran back through what we did, gave it to you in a cool artistic form. I got to finish on time, 8 minutes. So here's what I want to discuss, though. What Jesus says when here's the way 1 John, why did Jesus come? Why did the Father send the Son? Of course, it's because he loved the world. And there's a lot of facets for why Jesus came. But 1 John says this, the reason the Son of God appears was to destroy the works of the devil. That one of the things that Jesus came to do was to destroy this being and everything that he's done. So you tell me, we're going to take 2 or 3 minutes. What are some stories about Jesus or even passages in the New Testament that show you how he destroys this serpent or this Satan? Anybody? If John is telling you he came to destroy the works of the devil, how do you see that? What do you do? Raising Lazarus. So you see, if death is kind of one of Satan's tools, right? That's the ultimate decay. You see Jesus bringing life out of the grave, pushing back the darkness. Good. What else?
Healed.
That's right. This isn't saying that every bit of sickness is satanic, okay? We really do believe in medicine and all that kind of stuff, but it is saying that there is a spiritual element going on in this world that wants to decay things, that hates the human body, hates everything that God made, and is wanting to deteriorate. And you see Jesus putting things back together. Absolutely. Yes. I mean, all these demons show up when Jesus comes, which actually makes sense. If this is the one, the promised one that's finally going to crush the head of the serpent, he's here, the champion's here. So if that kingdom is starting to inbreak, what that means is there's all kinds of disruption. You're going to see this great movement of darkness trying to destroy this one. And he starts casting out demons. They flee at his word. And so you think about the man in the tombs in like Mark 6 or wherever that is. It shouldn't surprise us that when a man is possessed by many demons named Legion, where is he? He's out in the tombs. He smells of death. He's decay. He's being decreated in a real sense. That's right. When it said that Satan isn't for anything, it's just against stuff. That's it. It's just for tearing down. And then Jesus casts him out, and it says he sits there again in his right mind. He restores. Good. Anything else? Cleansing the temple. Yes, he gets evil and twisted stuff and manipulation of people out of God's space and basically casts it out, says you can't be here. Yes, I mean, Jesus says, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. Everything that Jesus says and does is capital T truth, which exposes the distortion of Satan. Satan wants you to think that God is not good. He cannot be trusted. And Jesus says, when you see me, you see the Father. And Jesus is goodness and truth and life and love on two legs. If you want to defeat the lies of Satan, look at Jesus. That's who God is. That's what God is like, not how Satan distorts him. And he's always speaking words of truth. Think about after his baptism. What happens with Jesus? Jesus goes out into the wilderness, this place of chaos, and he faces off with the devil. And it's really a replay of Genesis 3, except for being in a garden, it's in a place of wilderness. And Satan tries to tempt him. He tries to distort the Father. So he's basically saying, you can't trust the Father. Take care of yourself. Do your own miracle. Just bow to me and I'll give you what you want. And at every place, Jesus stands faithful against Satan's temptations by holding on to the trustworthiness of his Father. And that, of course, is a foreshadowing of what's going to come when he goes to a cross. And so in Colossians, look at this. Look how Paul puts it. He says, see to it that no one takes you captive by philosophy, empty deceit. It's kind of what Liza's saying. Don't let these lies capture you. Verse 13, you who are dead in your trespasses and uncircumcision of your flesh, God made alive together with him, having forgiven us all our trespasses by canceling the record of the debt that stood against us with its legal demands. This, he set aside, nailing to the cross. He disarmed the rulers and authorities and put them to open shame, triumphing over them. Which means on the cross, something actually happened to the serpent and his followers. They were disarmed. They were put into open shame. How? Well, if one of his weapons is he accuses you, right? And he does this all the time. If you've walked with Jesus for any amount of time, you know that like he makes us feel dirty. He makes us start thinking, God has got to be sick and tired of me, right? If he'll look at you and be like, man, if you can't control yourself on the internet, you know God's tired of you. If you can't control yourself at a bar, you know God's tired of you. If you still yell at your kids, you know he doesn't want anything to do with you. That is the accuser lobbing. Because that's a half-truth. You know, I did those things. But he distorts it and says, you know God doesn't want to be with you. But when my sin, my condemnation went onto Jesus, Satan has nothing to accuse. I cannot be condemned. And so you got to preach the truth to yourself. You got to say, you're right. I did those things. But Jesus Christ came in the world to save sinners. Oh, that's me. C.H. Spurgeon used to say, Satan tells me I'm unworthy, but I was always unworthy. Yet God has always loved me. And so if the condemnation is taken away, all Satan can do, if you'll learn to sit in the truth, is just remind you of your need of Jesus, which presses you farther into the truth, that my righteousness is in him. Right, sometimes we sing, well might my accuser roar, I know them all and thousand more, but Jehovah knoweth none. He has cast them away. Like, believe that. Satan makes us feel despair and fear, especially about death. And look what it's Hebrews 2. Since therefore the children share in flesh and blood, he himself likewise partook of the same things, that through death he might destroy the one who has the power of death, that is the devil. So, he also, like, yes, death is not the way things are supposed to be. Death is scary. But Jesus says, do not fear the one who can kill the body. Talking about Satan and those that he influences. And I'm like, yikes, he can do that. But he says, fear him who can destroy both soul and body in hell. That's talking about Jesus. And Jesus has taken the sting out of death. When he died and when he was resurrected, like Les is going to talk about today, it blew apart death. So that now death, Satan's weapon has been defanged. Nothing can separate you from the love of Christ, not even death. So he can oppose you, he can bring death, but now because of Jesus' resurrection, all that death does is bring you nearer to Jesus. That's all it does. And so we remember those things. We remember his death, his resurrection. We put on the full armor of God like Ephesians talks about, which means to live in truth. To avail yourself of the truth of Scripture. Remind each other of this in a community. Satan wants to isolate you so that you just think alone. A community needs to remind each other of the truth. It should not surprise us that Hebrews calls Jesus the champion of our faith. It's the same word that describes David, that he has defeated him. And we are following a Savior who's defeated death and Satan. Satan has been defanged. He's still prowling around, but he knows that the end is coming. And so he's just doing as much damage as he can before he will finally be gone forever. And so stay in the truth. Stay fixed on Jesus. Encourage each other with the truth. We don't have to defeat him. Jesus has. And he ends with this promise. I'll end here. In Romans 16, look how he says. He says, the God of peace, this is verse 20, will soon crush Satan under your feet. Isn't that awesome? That now the way that he's trampling Satan is through you. Through you forgiving others, through you loving enemies, through you living out the life with Jesus, it crushes Jesus under your feet. I mean, it crushes Satan under your feet. And the last thing I'll end with this, Joe Novenson says this, I think the worst judgment for Satan will not be the lake of fire. It will be when he realizes, listen to this, everything he did, every single thing was subverted and used to further and accomplish God's good purpose. That will drive him nuts. Les hinted at this last week with the cross, that Satan's instrument to try to destroy the seed, Jesus, the cross, you start realizing there was one who was subverting that, working through it to bring about his own defeat. And that's what Satan's going to realize is all of my best shots, there's one who is overworking and subverting it and working it for good. Think about China. When communist China, whatever, took over China in like 1950s and kicked out all the Christians, and started violence. They said there were something like a million Chinese Christians at that point. They kicked them all out. What is that, 70 years later? You know how many? People estimate there's 100 million Christians in China now. He can't win. The stuff he tries to destroy just seems to multiply Christians. It drives him crazy because he's been defanged, and there's a resurrected Savior who rules over all. So, that's all we got. It's 10:34. I'm not even going to close in prayer. We're done.